From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States announced on Friday that it hit Somalia with a drone strike a few miles southwest of Mogadishu on Monday. The Somali capital was the site of a horrific deadly bombing just a day before the U.S. drone strike, when a truck bomb killed more than 300 people and injured nearly 400. A former Somali army soldier who defected to the militant group Al-Shabaab was reportedly responsible for the devastating truck bomb. There is now speculation that a joint U.S.-Somali air raid in August that killed 10 civilians, including 3 children, may have been the provocation for the Mogadishu bombing a week ago. Meanwhile, questions are emerging around the U.S. involvement in Niger, where 4 U.S. special forces were recently killed. The Trump administration is keeping quiet about what U.S. troops are doing in that country. My guest is Dr. Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as a coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's also a senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus and an associate editor of Peace Review. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Good to be with you again.
Let's talk first about Somalia and this devastating bomb. It was a truck bomb. It's just unimaginable that a single truck bomb could have killed so many people, injured so many. Some folks here in the U.S. were pointing out to the hypocrisy of social media users and, you know, not expressing the same kind of sympathy for Somalis as they did for and have done for, you know, people in Europe and et cetera. It was absolutely devastating. As far as you know, Al-Shabaab has not taken responsibility for this bombing, right?
Not to my knowledge, though the perpetrator is believed to have Al-Shabaab connections. It's quite possible that he may have been acting alone, since he is from the town that was subjected to the deadly U.S.-Somali raid that you mentioned earlier that caused these civilian casualties. But the problem with Somalia, of course, and we've realized this since the initial U.S. Military intervention back in 1991, is that it is an incredibly complex situation with many different militia and armed groups, some clan-based, some ideologically based, some religiously based. And it's very difficult to map things out in a country that really has not had much in the way of a central governing authority for more than 25 years.
Now, some are speculating that Al-Shabaab may not want to take credit for this bombing simply because they are becoming hugely unpopular with the increased civilian casualties that have been seen responsible for. There were protests in Mogadishu around this terrible, deadly truck bombing, and so it's possible that they may be trying to distance themselves from it. But I think it's important for us to get the bigger picture, because on the one hand, most Americans may be completely unaware that the U.S. has any involvement in Somalia. You just mentioned 1991 when the first U.S. involvement began there. So what is the U.S. interest in Somalia? Is it primarily Al-Shabaab? Was Al-Shabaab even around in the 1990s?
Well, the United States did have a strong strategic interest in Somalia. Back in the late 1980s, when the United States set up a major military base, naval base, ironically on the site of a former Soviet base, the dictatorship of Barre, Siad Barre, had switched sides during the Cold War. And it was important because at that time, the United States did not have any basing rights in the Persian Gulf region, since, of course, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990, the United States has plenty of bases in the Persian Gulf region. They never didn't need Somalia anymore, and stood aside while the government there collapsed and the country fell into this kind of horrific factional fighting, which on top of the drought and other things created a humanitarian crisis that the Bush administration then on the name of in the name of humanitarian intervention, sent in the Marines to help distribute food that had been stolen by some of these militias. But of course, as we know what happened, the U.S. became yet another party in this multi-sided conflict. You had the classic case of mission creep. And the United States forces found themselves engaged in various fights with various clan leaders. And even after U.S. withdrew, the continued chaos led to a situation where radical Islamist forces came to the fore. And beginning in the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, U.S. became militarily engaged again of fighting these radical Islamists.
So what is al-Shabaab's status right now? Isn't it true that they have held and controlled parts of the country and at other times have lost control? And they're, you know, I don't know if it's too reductive to compare them to the Taliban in Afghanistan, but is this a militant organization that really has had the capability of controlling big sections of the country?
At times, they and their allies were able to control a fair amount of territory, but they have recently been on the retreat. They are like a number, like we're seeing with ISIS and with other extremist groups. Their hold on territory has been reduced, but their ability to inflict horrific damage is still, unfortunately, a reality.
Let's also talk about the timeline of events and what this latest U.S. drone strike means. So if it's true that the truck bombing might have been in revenge for the August attacks, you had an attack in August that killed 10 civilians, including 3 children. You had this truck bombing on Saturday in Mogadishu that killed 300 people, injured nearly 400, and that happened on from a local perpetrator. And then the U.S. drops another bomb on Monday near Mogadishu. Aren't U.S. strikes part of the problem? I mean, it's like the Pentagon is saying, "Oh, you killed 300 Somalis. We'll kill some too."
It is a tragic irony, and we've seen this throughout the greater Middle East, that the U.S. response to terrorism has been to create more terrorists. This is particularly true in societies like Somalia, where there is where the close clan ties lead to an ethic of revenge. That people in these large extended families feel obliged to avenge the deaths of their relatives from attacks by the U.S. and its allies by committing further atrocities. We've certainly seen this in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other parts of the world as well. And it's not like when a country is faced with a genuine threat of terrorism that some sort of military countermeasures aren't necessary. The problem is that the United States has tended to respond to such actions through aerial bombardment, which is a very blunt instrument that inevitably does lead to civilian casualties, which then just again perpetuates the cycle. And one would think after decades of watching this kind of phenomenon that American military and political leaders would realize that there's something off about this. I mean, even putting aside the moral and legal questions, just on a purely a strategic and tactical level, it seems like this really doesn't make any sense. And yet we're still seeing this going on again and again and again.
Let's talk about Niger. U.S. Special Forces, 4 of them were killed recently, and Trump came under fire for his tactless conversation with a mother of one of the soldiers who was killed. But the broader issue is, what are U.S. forces doing in Niger to begin with? And all we know from the military is that this incident where these 4 men were killed is an anomaly, because the U.S. has been conducting dozens of such incidents without casualties earlier this year. What are they doing in Niger, as far as you know?
Well, U.S. forces have been deployed in a number of countries in the Sahel region in Western Africa. The President Obama initially brought in 100 troops a few years ago to train the Nigerian armed forces in counterinsurgency, counterterrorist tactics. Since then, it's up to 800 soldiers, including at least 100 who are engaged in more active counterinsurgency efforts, as apparently were these U.S. special forces. They're basically there to track down and eliminate various militia groups allied with al-Qaeda. The problem, of course, is in this part of the Sahara, you have, in addition to the armed al-Qaeda and ISIS affiliated groups, you have various tribal militia, you have smugglers and others engaged in various non-terrorist related contraband, but who armed themselves. And given how dangerous it is, you have normal tribal groups who just happen to have a fair amount of weapons to protect themselves. And so it's very often difficult to discern who is who. And as a result, again, we are in a situation where we will support these attacks and sometimes engage in airstrikes. But who we are killing and what the impact of that will be is a matter of serious question.
Let's talk about the Islamic State. That's what the U.S. has claimed as its excuse increasingly in recent years for any kind of engagement in the Middle East and the Arab and Muslim world. We see now photographs of, going back to Somalia, al-Shabaab soldiers waving the ISIS flag, that iconic black and white ISIS flag. Also, apparently, some presence of Islamic State in Niger, however you might pronounce that with a French pronunciation or not. What is the extent of ISIS's hold in these two countries specifically, as far as you know, and does it justify U.S. Military actions in any way?
Well, al-Shabaab in Somalia and the various ISIS-affiliated militia in West Africa were initially homegrown movements, but with a similar extremist ideology, this kind of a cult-like distortion of Islam to advance their agenda. And announced their affiliation with ISIS only a couple years ago, when it looked like this movement was on the ascendancy, having captured large swaths of territory in Iraq and Syria. ISIS itself, in terms of the actual political military leadership, are almost exclusively Iraqis who were radicalized as a result of the U.S. invasion and occupation. Many of the leaders, in fact, were veterans in the notorious Abu Ghraib prison, where widespread abuse by U.S. soldiers has been documented. These local groups basically have essentially pledged fealty to ISIS. But in terms of direct coordination, it doesn't seem to be much to speak of, that this is an alliance of a convenience than one prestige or whatever, instead of a branch of the main body of the group that is still in Syria and Iraq, albeit in a much reduced territorial area.
Stephen, is U.S. policy in Somalia and Niger different under Trump than it was under Obama? Is it significantly different? Is it pretty much the same?
Well, what Trump has done is that he has greatly expanded the latitude of local and regional military commanders to engage in military action. Obama certainly supported the use of force and the stationing of American forces in these areas, but he was reticent to give the military a blank check. He insisted on personally approving any armed attacks, and he turned down quite a few requests, even those, of course, that he authorized, I would argue, in many cases were problematic, but at least they're somewhat limited. Whereas under Trump, he is basically giving the military a blank check. And of course, as we've seen throughout history, military leaders like to use their equipment, like to engage the enemy in ways that are generally more liberal than the political leaders and those who are aware of the broader political implications than they otherwise desire. And so basically what we are seeing is a genuine escalation and a very troubling one.
And, you know, we don't pay any attention here. Our media pays so little attention to what's happening in Somalia, what's happening in Niger, what's happening in actually a number of other African countries until there is massive death and destruction. And this is the problem. Or a small number of U.S. soldiers getting killed.
It's a real tragedy, too, because these countries are among the absolutely poorest nations in the world. And just a fraction of the money we are spending on the military and military engagements and arms assistance and training, that kind of thing, if it went into education, into healthcare, into sustainable economic development, it's hard to imagine these extremist groups would even get a foothold. I mean, I think it's I think Mali, which is another one of these countries that has been threatened by extremist groups, is an example of where when the people themselves have risen up nonviolently to bring democracy to the country, like they did back in 1991 against a U.S.-backed dictator, they were able to have decades of stability. And yet, with the armed uprising in Libya, NATO intervention, and the scattering of arms that resulted, Tuareg tribesmen ended up rising up. The military staged a coup against the democratic leader, a U.S.-trained officer, I should mention. That then resulted in the extremists taking hold of the northern part of the country, which led to French military intervention and resulting chaos. And if we just let the people alone to struggle to create a more just political and economic system, and our aid was restricted to the kind of assistance that could actually improve people's lives, it would create a situation where we would not have to deal with this kind of extremism and this massive death and destruction.
Right. Not only would the people in those countries be better off without U.S. bombs, Americans would be better off.
Yes,
we'd be safer.
Exactly.
All that our military interventions do is make things worse for everybody, ourselves included, but primarily for the people who are the targets of our bombings.
Indeed. Ever since 9/11, we have created more terrorists than we have killed. Mm.
Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and shedding some light on these issues. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he's also the coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. And he is the senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus and the associate editor of Peace Review. We've been discussing U.S. aggression in Somalia and Niger. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.